Yes, we are Damn Radio, and I am Samuel Trapp. This is International Flavor. Thank you. Hello, good evening, and welcome. Thank you for joining. Thank you for being here. Quite glad that you are. Plenty to get into tonight. There's a lot freaking going on, and I mean a lot. I've been a busy little beaver all day. Lots of personal labors, lots of things been going on that I've done. Anyway, I don't even know where to begin, but you know what I'm going to talk about tonight? I am going to talk about first. Remember a couple of weeks ago, might even only been about a week ago, I said something about a tsunami warning in Alaska, that there was an earthquake that occurred off of the southwest of Alaska about 600 miles, if I recall, and they were worried about tsunamis up there, and they were worried about them coming along, and then nothing ever came of it. It did not happen. So there were no earthquakes that took place. Well, I mean, the earthquakes took place, and they even took place several times, and they had a whole bunch of aftershocks for like a day and a half, but no tsunami. And that's because there wasn't any huge shift in the that caused a landslide underwater or anything like that. So I kind of keep track of these things because I have a I have a earthquake monitor on my phone. I have a shark alert monitor. All the things that I'm frightened of, I keep an alert on my phone to make sure that I don't run into any sharks. So if you're near the ocean, you know, what if you have to step your toe in the ocean? There could be sharks about. And so you got to keep track of that sort of thing. And if you don't, you know, that's just foolish on your part. They have an app for it now, and they can tell where these sharks are. So I have that. I have earthquake monitors and keep track where the earthquakes are. And I also have keeping track where volcanoes go off. Okay. So this is important stuff. You got to have this stuff in your life going on. Well, the reason I tell you about these dangerous things going on is because now an earthquake occurred off the Kuril Islands, Kamchatka side of the peninsula, the Russian side. A powerful earthquake off of Kamchatka Peninsula triggered a tsunami. This one did trigger a tsunami in the Far East. There's flooding all over the place. So a tsunami wave struck the northern Kuril Islands early Wednesday following a powerful earthquake in the Pacific Ocean, which prompted evacuation of residents from the coastal town of Severokurilsk. Regional officials confirmed the first wave hit the shoreline of Severokurilsk shortly after a magnitude 7.9 quake was registered near the Kamchatka Peninsula, according to the Sakhalin Regional Governor Valery Limarenko. Authorities ordered an evacuation of the town population, estimated at just over 2,500, to elevated areas away from the coast. Residents remain safe on high ground until the tsunami threat is lifted, said Limarenko. Emergency services are working in high alert mode, he stated, and that all necessary measures are being taken to ensure public safety, restore normal life in the area. Doesn't look normal to me from what I'm seeing of the footage. And wow. Footage shared by local media and officials show water reaching parts of the shoreline and residents climbing to higher ground as the tsunami sirens blared. There were no immediate reports of casualties or major damage, but the allayed fish processing plant in Severokurilsk was submerged with all employees quickly evacuated from the facility. And it's still half underwater. A tsunami threat has been declared across all the Kuril Islands following the powerful quake, said Ilyena Semyonova, head of the Yuzhno-Sakhalinsk seismic station, she told the news. Authorities in multiple settlements across the island chain are monitoring the coastline and continuing evacuation efforts as a precaution. Emergency services are still on pretty high alert, so of course, and I imagine they will be. Now, this has to be, of course, in my humble opinion, linked to the same earthquake event or series of events off of the Alaska coast, because, you know, they're not all that far apart. You know, I was going to make a quick query of, I don't know, Grok or ChatGPT or something, and see how far apart the Kuril Islands were from the Ptarmigan Arm, which is what they call that spot where those islands come out, you know, that the arm is the smaller part up on top, and then they have that series of arc of islands that come out, all of which have to do with earthquakes. Well, remember, Mount St. Helens is in that same chain, that same huge ring, which is all underwater these days, and so is Yellowstone. So, you know, it's a who knows what could be going on. And you know, people talk about Yellowstone being 100,000 years overdue or whatever, and that one would they say it'd be 500 mile circumference around Yellowstone. You know, pretty, you know, it'd be my luck if I went up there to go to Yellowstone and dip my toe in a hot spring. All of a sudden there'd be the I dip my toe in and a shark would bite me. No, I dip my toe in and a volcano would go off. That would be unbelievable, but would certainly happen if me. I always used to say, I'll never win the lottery, but if you want to take something with the same odds and say, you know, that a 2,000-ton weight would drop out of the sky and hit me in the head, which the odds are roughly the same as winning the Powerball. Well, or the, what's the other one? Well, certainly I would win. If it's like, if you're going to go outside, get hit by the 2,000 ton weight that magically drops from the sky, well, Sam's going to win that one, right? So, but we shall see what will happen with these. Earthquakes. I am less than happy with this scenario. And I feel bad for those people that are living over there. There's a lot of commentary on there. Mother Nature is extremely powerful. And, you know, it's a dangerous world we sometimes live in. So don't be heading up to Kamchatka right now, and or the Kuril Islands or Severokurilsk. Stay away from those places for now, if you would please, because that's unsafe out there, friends and neighbors. But the main thing I wanted to chat about today, after telling you all that, and by the way, if you feel like calling in, please do, 573-746-8020. Not saying I'll answer, but phone is certainly working, and if I'm not in the middle of something, I will certainly pick up and say hello. So if you'd like to, the things that have been bothering me lately, and I have haven't talked about it well, this week yet, I haven't really gone too deep into it, too far into what's occurring on the front in Ukraine, between Ukraine and Russia. And the old Trumpster, here he goes again. The guy changes his mind as often as some people change their underwear. And it just, this constant uncertainty in the world, where he imposes a sanction, then he takes it away, then he delays, and then it's always, you know, people always excuse him because it's the art of making the deal. Well, you know, it drives me crazy that you just change your stance all the time. Nobody knows what in the hell your stance really is on Ukraine and Russia, because you know, I've said this before, it's becoming, if it isn't already, it's his war and no longer Biden's. The days of him saying, "Not my war, it's Biden's," but that is those days are gone. The war is officially his, and he could have stopped it, and he didn't. He had the right idea. I think instinctively he knew, but he quit supplying arms. He quit supplying all of that. But then he got stuck in this crazy issue of buying valuable mineral resources under the, you know, very valuable mineral resources. And then is when it kind of started a little bit before that, when he was listening to Witkoff, then he wasn't listening to Witkoff, he was listening to Kellogg, then he wasn't listening to Kellogg. You're better off listening to Witkoff than Kellogg, but now I'm wondering what in the hell's going on with that too, because Witkoff seems to have been co-opted as well by the deep staters, by the globalist theory people that think that they're going to win, you know, that they can win this war. I mean, what is he going to do? In all seriousness, what's he going to do? What is left to him to offer Zelensky? Boots on the ground? Americans would have his head. Is he going to offer them missiles to strike deep inside of Russia? That's a huge mistake if he does. And what's he going to do? His options are escalate. Number one, allow NATO to escalate, which they've been trying to do for a while anyway. And they've been trying to convince him to do. Allowing the Lindsey Graham globalist types of the world to, I don't want to call it winning, because they're not winning. It doesn't matter what they do. It truly doesn't. If Europe and if the US aren't willing to nuke somebody, aren't willing to put boots on the ground, aren't willing to do something more than sanctions, nothing's going to change, okay? I have been trying to theorize what potential there is. First of all, the 50 days, everybody knew was a crazy proposition anyway. Everybody knew he'd change his mind before that in the first place, and that the 50 days would come up and then it'd go on to something else. So the fact that the 10 to 12 days has come up doesn't mean anything a whole lot different. It just means that he'll have to change his mind in 10 days or make a decision, because I believe the table has been set for a very long time. And everybody knows that Russia is not going to capitulate. Russia is not going to, sorry. They're going to rub their hands together and say they're sorry and go back, give Ukraine back Crimea, give them back Zaporizhia, Kherson, and the Donbass area. Why don't we do that? If you're not careful, you're going to lose the Dnipropetrovsk area and Kharkiv. You're going to lose those at a minimum. And if you're lucky, you don't lose all the way to the Dnieper River, like I've been saying for 3 freaking years. Those places are the vast majority are Russian speaking. Anyway, a lot of people who are, I don't want to say in the know, but who know things, are saying that the talk is even now that Ukraine won't survive this. Zelensky won't survive it. And for sure, Ukraine will not survive it, that they'll be divided into, you know, 3 different places. And so I've been trying to, I don't want to call it theorizing because it's not really a theory. It's the truth, you know? It's, let's talk about it. Let's go a little bit deep into it, okay? So this month is when, not too long ago, within the last few days, Donald Trump shortened his deadline for Russia to cease its war in Ukraine, okay? And it's, remember, he's taller than Putin, but right now Putin's bigger, okay? These are empty threats he's making. These are empty threats that Trump is making, especially if all you got in your pocket is sanctions and saying, yeah, we got sanctions and tariffs out of 100%. That theory is not going to work. I'd be happy to be wrong, but it ain't going to work. And so you can say I told you so later if you like. But I hate to say it, I'm right. It's, you know, even a blind squirrel finds a nut sometimes, right? But I'm right about this one, okay? He cut the initial 50 days that he said, where the hell did the 50 days come from? And people were having a heart attack over that. 50 days, oh my God, we're going to lose Pokrovsk, which might be the reason that they moved it down to 10. Because if Russia can't take Pokrovsk in the next 10 days, maybe they could do something, but they're not going to stop that part. You know, they're not going to stop it. But anyway, this ultimatum going down from 10 to 12, it carries heavy implications, right? Trump is threatening Lindsey Graham's punishing sanctions, punishing 100% tariffs, not just on Russia, but also on any nation trading with Russia if Moscow fails to make peace. And here's what I don't understand. Why is Moscow the only one we're worried about making peace? You know, let's be Mike Myers in his little quotes, you know, when he was talking about his laser that he was. Let's talk about the punishing sanctions. Let's talk about making peace by a new deadline. So Russia has to make peace. What does that mean? Given Zelensky his ceasefire, Russia has said what it takes to make peace. They've said it forever. Here's what you do. You're going to be neutral, like you said you would be. You're going to protect the Russians, Russian cultural and heritage rights of the people east of the Dnieper River. Well, actually everywhere, but mostly east of the Dnieper. You're going to quit... I don't mind if Ukrainian is in, it's not like it matters what I mind, but I don't care if they input a law saying that you can't, you have to, that Ukrainian is the national language and not Russian. That's fine. But you don't punish people for speaking Russian. You don't punish the Russian Orthodox Church. You don't change everything and close any private school that is speaking Russian. You don't. There's a new article came out today. Some Ukrainian lawmaker is wanting to impose a law that says it's forbidden to sing in Russian in Ukraine. What kind of BS is that? So in America, we can't sing in Spanish, right? None of that. Why in the world would you want to sing in Spanish? You're in America, right? You're in the U.S. Learn English, right? No, they say you still have your heritage. That ain't my culture and heritage. Remember that from Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? At any rate, he's going to put his punishing sanctions. The sharp reduction in time frame is, you know, pressing questions. What made him change his mind? Do we know? He doesn't want to talk to Putin anymore. He can't. You know why? Because Putin will change his mind. Trump has the bad habit of repeating whatever the last person was that he was talking to. So if he talks to Zelensky, he starts crying and wringing his hands and talking bad about Putin. But if he talks to Putin, he starts saying that Zelensky's a dictator. without elections, he's a dictator, you know, and he doesn't like Zelensky. I'm not sure he ever has, but at any rate, there's punishing sanctions coming. But seriously, what happened? What made him, was it battlefield reality? A lot of people think so, that the fighting around Pokrovsk, because Pokrovsk is about to be surrounded, okay? And that's bad. And Russia is winning this war. People are still dying, and Russia is winning. What are officials and observers from all sides saying? Not just me. So let's look into what the official U.S. explanations, the development of what's going on in the war, reaction from Ukraine and Russia, and you know, let's talk about some analysts and military bloggers and see what they say about it. These economic consequences, including the risk to the U.S. dollar that we talked about last night, by the way, and even any fringe theories that are going out on social media. Who knows, you know, about those? That could be a little bit of fun. So I've got plenty to go into. So let's talk about it. The U.S.'s official explanation, Trump's stance on ending the war has been back and forth since he took office. Initially, he said he could get it done in 24 hours. I could do it in one day. And but by mid-July, he, you know, in a grinding war, he said, well, you know, it was a lot tougher than I thought. And so here we are. I want a 50-day deadline. Well, that takes you to the end of summer, right? That takes you, you know, into autumn, and people are prepping for winter. And he sets this deadline till September. And then he said, if they don't settle by September, it'll be a very severe 100% secondary tariff on Russian goods and also against countries trading with Russia, right? But after 2 weeks of that, he shortened that window by half, basically. Said that because it's been 2 weeks, and he says now 10 more days. So he said that in July 28th. While he was in meetings in Europe, talking to the same old yahoos as he was before, he gave a new ultimatum, and he doesn't want to talk to Putin anymore. And he says it's to stop the killing. Now, I'm all for that, but I'm not for just stopping it so that Ukraine can regroup, tell us to go pound sand after we give them all the money. Then they'll find their stones again after that and say, oh, geez, no, we got to fight, because now we were able to stop Russia in their tracks. Now we can rebuild our trenches, rebuild our defenses, resupply our armies, remobilize people, and all within the 30-day ceasefire that they've wanted all along, and then start up again. That is the biggest reason that Russia has given from the very beginning. And by the way, they're sitting in the catbird seat, okay? But why? How does Trump explain his change? He said he was frustrated with the lack of progress, and people are dying. Well, I'm frustrated, and I'm frustrated that people are dying. But I'm more frustrated that we keep funding this. Why are we funding it? Why are we sending over and trying to figure out ways to send over $300 million worth of more Patriot systems? Why are we willing to say that it's all Putin's fault because he won't agree to a 30-day ceasefire? So because we're in on it. The Lindsey Grahams of the world are in on it. People still think they can win this war. But they can't win if they don't stop it in its tracks right now so that they can regroup. That's the unfortunate part. And Trump is buying into this crap, but I don't believe he's being told the truth, okay? So he said he was frustrated. There was no reason to wait. We just don't see any progress being made. Well, because you're not demanding it from Zelensky. What are you demanding from Zelensky? You're going to blame all this on Trump. And what are you demanding from Zelensky? Why don't you go tell Zelensky, look, stop this war? You telling me he could? You telling me if he didn't say, listen, you stop, And you figure out what line you're comfortable with, because the Ukrainians are dying here far more than the Russians are. Now, you can believe what you want on that, but have a look at these numbers. They are not the 46,000 in 3 years. Zelensky is claiming that he's only lost 15,000 a year. Uh-huh. Yeah, right. But he told reporters that no progress was being made, and he's disappointed in President Putin. Now, a month ago, he was disappointed in Zelensky and calling him names after discussions with Putin on the phone. But now they're keeping him away from Putin and saying, see, Putin ain't stopping this war. He won't agree to the 30-day ceasefire. Well, no, he won't. And he's been extremely clear about that for years, for the entire time period we're talking about, right? He says he talks about peace but continues to bombard Ukrainian cities. Well, what are the Ukrainians doing on the other side? They're begging so that they can come bomb ours, but they're still sending in all kinds of, what do you call them? UAVs. In Scotland, and he was with, of course, Keir Starmer, you know. He's a Keir Starmer, the genius, right? Trump said he was not too interested in talking anymore to Putin because too many people are dying, and so therefore it's suddenly urgent, like it wasn't before, right? He said if Russia doesn't show real movement toward peace by the new deadline, the U.S. will impose the promised sanctions and tariffs immediately. If you know what the answer is going to be, why wait? Well, you know what the answer is going to be, so why wait? Impose your sanctions now. Quit playing games here. Either impose your sanctions and forget about it. It's not going to change anything. These sanctions aren't going to mean a damn thing. So he also added, I don't want to do that to Russia, you know, because he has an affection toward the Russian people, right? But Putin's got to make a deal. Too many people are dying. Why does Putin have to make a deal? Putin is winning. Putin's winning. And your sanctions aren't going to do much. You know, there might be a little bit of, what do you call it? Hardship in the beginning, but it's not doing anything. So let's take a look at this. It was about July 14th that he put in this 50-day ceasefire, which would have taken him all the way September 3rd, right after Labor Day. Might have been the reason he picked it. So Trump vowed 100% tariffs on Russia and its trade partners, and he intended to pressure Putin with economic pain, but he wanted to be generous with time, right? And then on July 28, 2 weeks later, he was disappointed and he changed it. He believes that waiting longer is futile. He set August 8 as the ceasefire day, and tariffs will start basically 10 days from today. Trump's new hard line was, you know, some direct quotes. 50 days, I wanted to be generous, but we just don't see any progress. So I'm going to make a new deadline of about 10 to 12 days. Yeah, that's a real solid deadline, isn't it? Why don't you just tomorrow say, screw it, I'm entering the order to put sanctions on. Lindsey Graham and his crew can all act like it's going to work and see what happens. Because it doesn't look like he doesn't look like he put anything else in place. The official U.S. explanation is impatience with Putin's stalling. So it's only Putin that's stalling, right? What is Ukraine offering? The Zelensky victory plan of a year ago, year and a half? What are they offering? Give us back Zaporizhia. Give us back all these places you took from us. That's the only thing they've said they want, right? We don't see any progress. That's right. So let's talk about the battlefield developments and why this is important. So you can't separate, you know, Trump's change from the losses on the battlefield, reality in Ukraine. This summer offensive around the strategic city of Pokrovsk in Donetsk. Pokrovsk became the most active front in the war. Russia put an entire 110,000 troops there for months. The Ukrainians had, held their own around Pokrovsk, and were losing all kinds of people. And but by late July, Russia was moving forward rather swiftly every day. And they have Pokrovsk just about surrounded even now. And they're on the outskirts of several of the areas of Pokrovsk right now. Let's see. Pokrovsk is a strategic place. It was once called the gateway to Donetsk. It sits on key roads and rail lines used by Ukraine to supply many areas in the eastern positions like Chasiv Yar, Konstantinivka, and it lies near Ukraine's only coking coal mine and has significant pre-war population of about 60,000, most of whom are evacuated by now. If Russia does take Pokrovsk, it would pave the way to push through to larger cities of Kramatorsk and Slavyansk, which are nearby, and would further disrupt logistics, and Russia taking the rest of Donetsk. Okay. In broader terms, success could open the approaches to the Dnepropetrovsk region, like I've said, right? And they're already in a tiny bit of Dnepropetrovsk right now. So throughout the spring, Ukraine was barely able to hold the line at Pokrovsk. And, they put experienced brigades. That's where they were losing because of the idiocy of going into Kursk. Frankly, their generals ought to be excoriated for that, because what a waste of time that was. Oh, we want some land to trade. Oh, yeah? How about you hold on to Pokrovsk, you morons? So now here we are having to change what Trump is having to change what he said he was going to do, because these idiots wanted to go into Russia as if they could hold it. You know, short term, you might have a little bit of short term gain, but long term, you aren't keeping it. So, well, we didn't stop trying, did we, Ukraine? You know, unbelievable. But by July 28, the time that Trump was shortening his ultimatum, the situation in Pokrovsk was pretty dire, and it's getting worse, okay? Zelensky acknowledged small groups of troops had gone into the city, and then he insisted they were all destroyed, but he's lying. And the incursions underscored that time is not on Ukraine's side. Putin won't make any concessions unless he's forced to by significant Ukrainian victories, said one think tank. So Putin has definitely achieved battlefield momentum, and he's had it for the entire summer operation and probably before that. And he's been taking, like I've reported here, every day another several kilometers. So no, is he? Somebody asked me the other day and said, well, if Russia's so big, why aren't they just kicking the crap out of, why haven't they just rolled over Ukraine? Ukraine had a million-man army. Ukraine's lost a lot of people, and Ukraine is fighting to hold its own. That don't mean they're going to win, and Russia is not trying to kill off all of their soldiers, nor are they trying to kill all the Ukrainians. They keep bombing the hell out of everything, which nobody likes. I'm not saying I like it, but it makes sense if you're playing to win, and they're playing to win. They, like I told you, for 3 years now, they have been fighting for what they call their very soul and existence. Russia is discounted everywhere. Russian culture, Russian people, Russian everything. They're not welcome anywhere. And it's nonsense. It's just BS. And so, we have to hate the entire population, not just Putin. We got to hate everyone, right? So especially in Pokrovsk, Russia's advance, Ukraine is having huge losses on its own side. But Russia's losing some too, right? Each day of fighting means that they're saying that between the two, 1,000 are dying. Now, that's more on the Ukrainian side than on the Russian side, but both are losing far too many. This battlefield picture provides a little bit of context for Trump. The U.S. peace efforts, if you want to call them that, they failed to gain any momentum. Well, it's because you keep supplying them with more stuff, and you keep claiming that something's going to be different than it is, and it's not. Okay, so Russia has been doing nightly bombardments of more than 300 drones plus cruise and ballistic missiles. I saw a report last night that said that by the end of the summer, Russia is going to have the ability to do 2,000 Shahed drones a day all over Ukraine. 2,000. I think they're losing their asses. And, you know, they the other night, they targeted 73 cities and villages across Ukraine with 300 drones. And days before that, they did 700 and something. 85 people injured, 22 Ukrainians killed. Let's see. Zelensky says he needs very harsh and very painful sanctions on Russia. They're not going to work. Okay? Lindsey Graham aside, they're not going to work. Okay? He said that he's trying to, you know, get Trump to listen to him, right? Saying that these attacks were done after a complete position was voiced by the United States that Russia must end this war and move to diplomacy. Well, when are you going to move to end the war and diplomacy? When are you going to capitulate? When are you going to say enough's enough? And sit down and talk. Why don't you say, all right, we're going to quit fighting. Quit resisting. Say we're done. Well, how is that wrong? Right? How is that? Most of the Ukrainians are willing to stop right now. There's been quite a few surveys, polls on this, said that the Ukrainians are willing to give up right now. And it's a pretty sizable majority. I want to say like 72%, the last numbers that I saw. So this accelerating battlefield events, especially around Pokrovsk, have added to Trump's ultimatum. The 50-day window might have allowed Russia to capture Pokrovsk, and maybe they're saying if they cut it to 10 days, Russia won't take it. But if all you're going to do is give them sanctions, you might as well kiss it goodbye anyway. Sit down at the table, Zelensky, and make a deal. Make a deal. Stop it. Keep Pokrovsk. Now, Russia wants Donetsk. They want all of it. Donetsk has spoken. Donetsk has done a referendum. The U.S. referendums only count, you know, and we can only support them on the from NATO if we determine that they're fair, right? You don't get a say that anybody else's referendums surely can't be fair, right? Only the U.S. can have fair referendum. We would only support fair referendum, right? Like happened in Serbia, like happened in Kosovo, right? Those very fair ones where NATO is still sitting. Never left, right? They've never left. So what does Moscow say about all this? And some military bloggers, right? The original 50-day version and the new 10 to 12 day deadline are doing nothing but provoking, like even from me, scornful reactions from president, you know, from what do you call it? Speakers, political commentators, defiant officials. The Kremlin's formal response to the initial 50-day demand even rejected that as unacceptable and insisted that Russia will continue its special military operation until it meets its objectives, which it's been saying from the beginning. Deputy Foreign Minister Sergei Rybakov on July 15 said any attempts to make demands, especially ultimatums, are unacceptable. And he called for continued negotiation considering Russia's terms. Instead, Rybakov reiterated Putin's line that Moscow prefers diplomacy, but if we cannot achieve our goals through diplomacy, then the special military operation will continue. This is an unshakable position. Who else has said it? Sergei Lavrov. I watched another speech of his last night in front of a youth university where a bunch of young people were there. And they all stood up and were, you know, applauding him and very much listening. And they're very glad to be in front of him. They respect him. They honor him. And he was saying the same things there. You know, that here we are and, you know, nobody's listening to us. So we're going to do what we said we were going to do. Period. Dmitry Peskov took a cautious tone initially, saying Trump's announcement was a serious announcement and Moscow needed time to analyze it. And then he said some of Trump's comments were personal to Putin and hinted Putin might respond if and when he thought it was necessary. Putin stayed silent on the ultimatum, and the Kremlin took the line that it took note of Trump's comments, but other Russian officials have not been so restrained. Former President Medvedev, Dmitry, who's funny, known for his hawkish, bombastic rhetoric, lambasted Trump's move as a theatrical ultimatum, and he declared that Russia didn't care about it. Well, most people in Russia do not care about it. They're going to do what they said they were going to do anyway, right? When Trump shortened that deadline to 10 days, Medvedev amped up the rhetoric even further. He said this past weekend, each new ultimatum is a threat and a step towards war, not between Russia and Ukraine, but with Trump's own country, is what he said. Medvedev insinuated that Trump's actions are bringing the U.S. closer to direct conflict with Russia, effectively invoking World War III. In a snide exchange on X, he even taunted Senator Lindsey Graham, called him Gramps, and told Washington to work on America first after Graham spoke out supporting Trump's stance. Well, Graham, you know, Graham Cracker. Maybe we should call him Gramps Cracker. He's funny. Medvedev, I mean. Beyond officialdom, Russian military bloggers reacted with vitriol and ridicule of Trump's ultimatum. These influential pro-war people, which are hundreds of thousands of followers, say that Trump is naive, arrogant, or performing for domestic politics. A January 2025 roundup of responses. Let me give you a bunch. One prominent blogger, German Kulikovsky, Starsha Eddy, said that good old Donald is a typical American salesman, not a politician. Nothing but lies in a speech, all to sell an uninformed average person a poor quality product, he said. A guy named Alexei Kargapoltsev, and his call sign on Telegram is Zapiski Veterana, Writings of a Veteran, interpreted Trump's message bluntly. Either do as I say, or I'll pressure you even harder with sanctions. He said that peace is impossible on such terms. Russia cannot accept what is offered, and Ukraine will not agree to what Russia demands. And so the war is going to go on regardless. Agreement with Sam's position. I didn't tell him what to think. I'm telling you what I think. And he said that Ukraine should prepare for the complete destruction of its male population, and Russia should prepare for a long and grueling war. Rather grim, but that's the way it's going to go. A channel that I always watch on Telegram called Dva Majora, Two Majors. They say that Trump's public ultimatum showed that he doesn't understand Russia or who he is dealing with. Now, I've been making that comment forever. If you think that you can just tell Russian people what to do, you don't know Russians very well. You just don't get it. And they said he doesn't understand. Nothing will be agreed to under that kind of pressure. They also asked, why should Russia trust the U.S. given all of its past cheating? Which is true, by the way. This is a common Russian commentary that U.S. promises cannot be believed. And they cannot. You know, think about this. We won't go an inch to the east. And 9 times we've gone there. NATO is where? NATO's all over Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, Poland, Finland. They're on Russia's border right now. What would make you think that Russia was going to put up with Ukraine doing that? And everybody knew it. And they ignored it completely because Russia didn't do anything about the rest. So they don't believe it. And the U.S. doesn't follow its own treaties that they put in that I worked on. We have a habit of changing the rules every 4 years. We have we get to have Hillary Clinton say that you know, Donald Trump encouraged Putin to help him win elections in 2016. I mean, it's pretty comical what they what they put out there, right? And Russia, they never listen to Russia, and they haven't. Okay, so let's see who else. There's a guy named Boris Rozhin. His name is on Telegram is Colonel Kassad. Noted Trump's threats of new sanctions were nothing new. We've already been through this under Biden, he said. Attempts to change Russia's position through primitive threats aren't likely to bring Trump the outcome he desires. That's what I say. You're not going to get the outcome you think you're going to get. Not remotely. Okay? Guy named Alexander Kotz, who has Kotz News. He's a well-known war correspondent. He framed Trump's plan bluntly as an ultimatum and economic blackmail. He warned fellow Russians to prepare for the worst, predicting they might soon nostalgically consider Biden's term a relative thaw if Trump unleashes economic war, like he says he's going to. He said that Trump may feel omnipotent after allegedly brokering a Gaza ceasefire, right? But Russia isn't Gaza. Starting a dialogue with ultimatums isn't the most far-sighted move for a would-be peacemaker. I happen to agree wholeheartedly with that. And Moscow will never agree to any deal dictated through blackmail or threat. He calls, you know how I sometimes call Trump Donald Jayevich? He calls him Donald Fredovich and told him to leave and return as a proper statesman, not an overconfident king of the playground, you know, who doesn't have to talk to anybody. He doesn't want to. So in late July of 2025, these attitudes just remain. Russian state media amplifies all over the place. Medvedev's line that Trump's ultimatum is empty theater and Russia would continue its course. Hardliners in Moscow say they prefer Trump's tougher approach in one respect, and they argue it proves the U.S. wants to directly go at it with Russia and that Russia isn't really fighting Ukraine, but is fighting NATO and America. And that's true. That's absolutely true. We're the ones paying for it all. If we weren't paying, they couldn't do it. Even if the NATO countries or the EU wanted it to happen, without us, it wouldn't happen. Okay? It couldn't happen. As a prime example, you know, this is fighting Medvedev's step towards war with his own country comment is a prime example that casts Trump as essentially declaring economic war, not just on Russia, but potentially provoking military conflict with Russia in America, right? This is not the way to win the hearts and minds of Americans or Russians. It is also worth noting that some Russian sources claim that, like Peskov, he said Trump's 50-day window was serious, but given time to analyze it, Russian markets actually rose after they talked about it because they know where they're headed. And especially after the 15 July, when they talked about it, they thought it would, was shortened, when he took it down to 12 days, Peskov noted on July 29th, they took note of it and didn't make any further comment. This might say that they think that Trump's threats are a bluff and aimed at more signaling because he changes his mind like they changed their underwear. But in sum, Moscow's line is that Trump's ultimatum is basically a threat and blackmail, and it's not going to work. And I happen to agree with that. What does Ukraine say about all this? Here's Ukraine. They say, this is great. This is great pressure. Now give me some missiles. Ukraine has applauded Trump's stance. They think, like many delusional people, that sanctions are going to work. They're not. 18 packages of sanctions have not worked. In fact, people are learning to be able to get around them all over. I told you about that in yesterday's program. China's there, India's there, Brazil is there, Iran is there, Indonesia is there. Lots of countries are trading in their own currency so they don't have to be affected by the sanctions. The trade with the U.S., They're all finding different places to trade. They're trading among each other. It's not as important to come to us. We're kicking ourselves right in the royal behind is what we're doing. So in Zelensky's eyes, Trump's move signaled a clear stance and a determination that Russia must end this war, right? Zelensky thanked President Trump for his focus on saving lives and stopping this horrible war. Yeah, where's your focus on saving lives and stopping this horrible war? Sanctions aren't going to stop it. And I believe Trump knows it, Zelensky knows it, everybody in the European Union and NATO know it as well, right? It says Russia pays attention to sanctions and pays attention to monetary losses. Russia's economy has gone up under sanctions. You hurt yourself with sanctions and these tariffs. And nobody trades with Russia anyway. We talked about that last night. So let's keep on going, right? So Andrei Yermak says, Putin understands only strength, and that has been conveyed clearly and loudly. Oh, really? I think it's a pansy move. That's what it is. The manly move would be to cut off Zelensky and say, you will stop this war. Or we'll cut you off. We'll quit providing this to you. Tell me what justifies continued wasting of money. What's going to happen in 10, 20 days? Is Lindsey Graham going to have another package to send another? One Ukrainian official asked for last week? He said they needed every year $120 billion. 75% of that put up by the United States. That's what we needed. And the rest could come from NATO, with the U.S. giving up a bunch of that too. Nonsense. So Yermak thanked Trump and said Zelensky shared his sentiments. So Ukrainian leadership believes that only decisive pressure, especially economic, would compel Putin to consider peace. It ain't going to work. Ukraine's tone on Trump, too, has evolved. Remember, they didn't like him at first. They still don't like him, but they know they got to deal with him. During Trump's first months in office, when negotiations were led by Steve Witkoff, they seemed to lean toward giving Russia major concessions, Kyiv grew anxious. Well, that because Witkoff was doing the right thing, right? But by late July, with Trump now openly disappointed in Putin and willing to tighten the economic screws, Ukraine has expressed encouragement. Foreign Minister Dmytro Kuleba even said he welcomes the U.S. finally recognizing that Russia must be dealt with firmly rather than coddled. Yes. crazy. From Ukraine's perspective, Trump's 50-day ultimatum was positive but too lenient. That's why they all pounced on him in Europe this past week to say, man, you can't wait another 25 days. We'll lose Pokrovsk. Can't do that. There is, of course, a degree of political calculation from Zelensky. Zelensky is ensuring that Trump feels validated for taking a harder line by applauding Trump. Zelensky hopes to lock in Trump's resolve and dissuade any reversal. That's why people are trying to get him to not talk to Vladimir Putin, right? It serves to show that Ukraine, the Ukrainian public, that the U.S. is in their corner, right? And Zelensky gets to stay in power while the war drags on, right? Other influential Ukrainian voices and military bloggers support the idea that more pressure on Russia is good. Some commentators said the 10-day ultimatum is finally treating Russia like a terrorist state. They say that Putin only responds to ultimatums backed by force. And so, I don't know. Here we go. Ukraine and its allies, like Graham in the U.S. or Starmer, clearly had a hand in encouraging Trump's tougher position. Keir Starmer's meeting with Trump on July 28 in Scotland was officially about other topics. But no doubt Starmer reinforced importance of stopping Russian aggression, as they like to call it. UK has been one of Ukraine's strongest backers. Trump said he has not heard from Russia about the new timeline, but he certainly heard from America's allies, you know, certainly heard from Starmer and Zelensky. Oh, this is great. So let's talk about the influence of Trump's advisors and other public figures. Trump's shift from the long 50-day period to the immediate 10-day didn't happen in a vacuum. It was shaped by debate within his own administration, input from his, I'll say, crazy advisors, as well as interactions with other foreign leaders. Understanding who and what influenced Trump is helpful here. Let's talk about Steve Witkoff, right? He's the most pivotal insider and has been on the Russia side for a long time, well, since Trump took office. He initially advocated a conciliatory approach toward Russia. In talks in 2025, he pushed a strategy that would give Russia ownership of the four eastern Ukrainian regions Moscow claimed to annex in 2022 as part of a ceasefire. This meant that Putin gets territorial gains, and that's a reward. And Ukraine rejects that, although they've already lost it. And many U.S. officials find it alarming. How can we do that? Well, only we can take over other people's territory without consequence. Only the U.S. can do that. Only if we are behind it will that be permitted, right? No other country can do that, you know? God forbid China try to take over something. Hell, India, figure it out. Pakistan, right? Figure that out. It's only the U.S. that's allowed to do it, or somebody on our behalf, with our funding and our backing. Our puppets are allowed to do so, but nobody else on the planet, it's only the deep staters, only the globalists that are allowed to do this. And now Witkoff is in that same camp, although initially he wasn't, right? Witkoff even argued publicly that settlement was emerging and talked about permanent peace. This is a couple of months ago. He dismissed Ukraine's NATO ambitions back then, and he downplayed the illegitimacy of Russia's referendums. So everybody wants to say that Russia's referendums were illegitimate. Well, Witkoff was going, well, who gives a rip? It's over now. It's over, and this is how we stop people from dying, whether you trust them or not. You know, what are you going to do? Say that, oh, gee, Russia, give them back. Russia's not giving it back. Get used to it, okay? There's nothing you're going to do to force that except go to war. And who's going to go to war? Even NATO won't go to war against Russia. They won't do it. Certainly won't do it without the U.S. Mm-hmm. In March and April of 2025, Witkoff met Putin multiple times, came away optimistic, and, you know, but Putin's subsequent, now we're going to blame Putin here. It's all Putin. Putin, Lavrov, Peskov, Zakharova, pick anyone. Every single one of them. Nebenzia, the guy, the UN ambassador, has been, all of these people have been completely open and transparent and have not changed what they said for the last 3 years with what they will do to what this will happen. It's not going to change. It will not change with this. Okay. Now they say everything is Witkoff's approach is now soured. It was apparent that Putin was stringing along negotiations. How do you figure he's stringing along? By saying exactly what he wants. I'm not giving you a 30-day ceasefire. I'll give you a peace deal. What good's a 30-day ceasefire going to do? What are you going to do? Oh, we know what you're going to do. You're going to get together, dig new trenches, dig new places, rearm your people, and we're going to have to start this all over again. But we're winning right now. Bring your sanctions. We don't give a rip. We'll deal with them. If they come apart, you know, come upon us, we shall deal with them, right? Ukraine's demilitarization, that would mean the effective end of Ukrainian statehood. Now, I don't know how that would be, but that's what they were claiming. And Trump grew frustrated that Russia has yet to accept a 30-day ceasefire that has been proposed. Well, because it wasn't proposed as a permanent ceasefire. Then they keep ignoring that little part, right? According to Reuters, two partial ceasefire deals, one on energy infrastructure, one on Black Sea grain. Remember that? Weren't ever backed up, and Ukraine didn't follow them anyway. Each time he talked about the support for it, nobody did it. The Atlantic Council said that Trump had repeatedly signaled that he was ready to accept most of the Kremlin demands, but then he didn't do it, did he? And they keep blaming Putin for the stalling. Nothing on the other side. Not one word on the other side. And that's just lying. Flat out lies. You know, as an experiment, it would be really interesting to do. But Russia won't, and rightly so. But think about this. If you today, if Russia said, all right, let me prove my point. And the trouble is it'll cost you a ton more lives, you know. It could cost you another 30,000 lives that you don't need to lose, okay? Suppose today that Russia said, all right, for the month of August, we're going to give you a ceasefire. Total ceasefire, freeze the combat lines right where it is. Do your worst. What you would see in 30 days, you wouldn't see a final end to the war on the lines that are already there. You would see Ukraine setting up new equipment, setting up new air defense, setting up new trenches, bringing in another level of conscripts. They would immediately pass something to lower the conscription age down to 21 or 18 or something to get people to join the military, and would restock, resupply, the U.S. would give them the $110 billion that they're asking for. And then we would start all of this over again in September. Why would Russia do that? So at least if Russia keeps on fighting, it's the winter before too long. It's going to get cold over there. And the winter will bring some stall in movement anyway. Not as much as it was, because Russia is still on the advance. But it'd be fun to do. Fun. Why did I say that? Fun. But it would be interesting to take that kind of take on it. Because then you would find out that I am absolutely right. And Trump and company are absolutely wrong, because they are lying from the top down. And maybe not Trump. Trump wants this over, but everybody else is lying and they're playing him. Lindsey Graham, these idiots still think they can win. They still think they're going to win. They're not winning. This is nonsense. Well, at any rate, after all of these things, and by mid-2025, Trump was recalibrating, leaving what Wyckoff was asking him to do, because people like Kellogg and people like Lindsey Graham finally got his ear. You know, the war wasn't over in 2 days, and so now these idiots have his ear. These idiots don't want the war over. They want a delay. They want a 30-day ceasefire, but they want it so it will continue, and it will be a war of attrition for the next 10 years. So I think that Russia will stop after Dnipropetrovsk and Sumy, you know, and Kharkiv. But they may stop just if they take over the Donbass and they stop. I think they may stop if they get the rest of Donetsk. That's a possibility, because those are the goals of what started this war. It'd be interesting to see what does happen. But if Ukraine keeps fighting and keeps pressing, then they're going to end up in Odessa. They're going to end up losing, what's the one down below there? Nikolaeva. They're going to end up losing that one too. So, Lindsey Graham, another critical outside influencer who's an idiot, a Republican senator known for his hawks. Remember, we're going to start calling him Hawk. Hey, Hawk, what's happening? His hawkish foreign policy. Never met a war he didn't love. You know, it's hard not to love a good war, right? Graham has a unique relationship with Trump. Sometimes ally, sometimes critic. Graham firmly supports aiding Kiev and punishing Moscow. Guy thinks he's punishing Moscow, right? He visited Ukraine more than he visits his home state and declared that Russia is dying in the war. You know, Russians dying in the war is the best money we've ever spent, he said. And that, you know, that's what an idiot. To say stuff like that. That is no diplomat, not remotely. Graham likely is the person counseling Trump that he's being too soft on Putin. And when Trump first announced the 50-day deadline, Graham, along with Blumenthal, you know, the old Blumenthal, both of them are in each other's pockets, Blumenthal and Graham. You don't know where Blumenthal ends and Graham begins. They said, oh, it's a powerful warning. And they'd been pushing bipartisan legislation for more sanctions, right? But after the deadline was shortened, Graham became Trump's attack dog on Twitter, directly speaking to Medvedev and warning Russia's partners. This suggests that Graham was actively encouraging Trump to what he says, tighten the screws. Trump values strength, and he would hear from Graham that anything less than immediate action would be seen as weakness. the fact that Graham calls it a bloodbath, or says that he's going to create an economic bloodbath, and told Russia they would be mistaken about Trump's resolve, indicates an effort to play Donald Trump. That's what he's doing. He's playing Trump. Because Trump, you know, likes the accolades. It's all about him and always has been. More power to him, by the way. I don't have any problem with that. I don't have a problem with Trump being who he is. But he's not... If you're making decisions in a vacuum where the only real advice you're getting is from Lindsey Graham, you got problems. You know, that's nonsense. The next one, let's talk about Zelensky. While Trump and Zelensky haven't had a known formal meeting in 2025, except, you know, the 15 minutes in the Vatican. Excuse me. Zelensky's influence has been indirect through public statements and talking through people like Graham or Kellogg. I think it's the reverse. I think Kellogg and Graham are keeping Zelensky away from him because Trump doesn't like Zelensky. Not remotely. Zelensky, what do you call it, campaigned for the Democrats when Trump was running for office. And in 2016, he released that report that said that Trump's representative was hiding money in Ukraine, was helping hide money over there. He started part of the Russiagate stuff, right? Or supported that when it came out later. And that is, and Zelensky has been, that was back when this was released back in 2020. Nonsense. And so Trump doesn't like Zelensky. So if you keep him away and you only have to listen to Graham or Kellogg, not even Witkoff anymore, then you might have a chance at corralling Donald Trump. And that's what they're doing. They're corralling Donald Trump. So Zelensky made clear that Ukraine would never occupy or never recognize the occupied territories as Russian. This stance has been relayed to Trump's team. And it was first Witkoff who sat in a meeting with senior Ukrainians in Paris along with Rubio. They convinced Trump that Ukraine would not agree to the overly pro-Russian deal Witkoff was floating. But nobody cares about what Russia wants. We're okay to, oh no, they'll never agree. So you can say that Ukraine will never agree, but you're not allowed to say that Russia will never agree. I don't understand that philosophy at all, especially when Russia is winning. Russia is not losing. Russia is winning. And so something needs to happen here, people. And I still think that Trumpster ought to just cut him off. The easiest way to end this is to cut him off, right? Let's talk about the old Keir Starmer, Stormtrooper Starmer. Trump's meeting with Starmer on July 28th was hours before Trump went public with reducing the deadline from 50 days down to 10, right? We don't know what their private discussion was, but the UK has been pumping this nonsense for a long time. And Starmer, you know, he's like a cheerleader out there. Starmer conveyed Britain's steadfast support for Ukraine and his skepticism that Putin would respond to anything but force. But he ain't going to respond to economic force. He probably wouldn't respond to force. It's not going to happen. British officials have shared intelligence and battlefield assessments that underscore urgency. They're the ones who are going to go, look, we're going to lose Pokrovsk. You better get over there. The optics of Trump sitting by Starmer when he announced this new ultimatum, you know, that was a pretty big deal too. It signaled a united front with Starmer. Starmer's influence here is subtle, which is Starmer isn't liked in his own country, but he's liked in Ukraine, right? But it gave Trump confidence, you know, to be more hawkish while sitting there to show off to somebody, because that's what Trump likes to do. Finally, let's talk about Trump's shift being influenced by in a broader context. By summer of 2025, Trump has faced criticism for not having ended the war in 24 hours, as he often boasted. His approval ratings have gotten a little bit stagnant, and his critics on the left and the right are poised to seize on any failure. The initial 50-day deadline was mocked by a bunch of people as arbitrary and too long. Some on Reddit joked the administration doesn't understand the concept of a deadline because he's always imposing deadlines and then taking them away. You know, and by shortening it, Trump creates a sense of action and some crisis. Maybe he could get some Americans to rally around him for this, especially if Putin doesn't yield by early August. He can say he did everything possible and it's just Putin's fault, that Putin has to, you know, Putin caused his own sanctions. I told him what was going to happen. But the sanctions, nobody cares, friends and neighbors. They just don't. Tell me why these are important, Lindsey Graham. They aren't going to change a damn thing. There's precedent during Trump's first term. He oscillated under advice from hardliners like John Bolton versus steelmakers. But in this case, the hardliner voices have been way ahead of the conciliatory voices since the 15th of July, right? So in sum, Trump's opinion has evolved, right? It's evolved, and I do know what's going to happen. These sanctions will be imposed. Doesn't matter if they come in 50 days or 10. It makes no difference. So you got another month of hard times. Okay. Hard times isn't going to stop a Russian. It's not going to happen. And it's not going to stop any of the other countries that are dealing with the Russians either. They're going to muddle through it as they have been. And refer to last night's show. Go out to internationalflavor.com and listen to last night's show, because the economic field of dreams isn't all that dreamy on the U.S. side, especially because they're accelerating. And this is another chink in the armor of the U.S. dollar, another forced deal for Poland, China, Russia. Everybody's buying gold. Everybody's buying it. That knows what's going to happen. They're buying gold. Countries I'm talking about, to back up their own currency. So what are these sanctions? Let's talk about this. Under Trump's plan, if Russia doesn't agree to a ceasefire, the U.S. will not only reinstate full sanctions, but it will then impose secondary tariffs of 100% on any country still doing significant business with Russia. Plenty of Americans are doing business with Russia, by the way. These tariffs will target key sectors: energy, agriculture, defense. And they're trying to choke off trade that props up Russia's war. They always want to call it Russia's war. This is NATO's war. More than a dozen countries are in the crosshairs. The biggest, ready? China. Not going to work. China, Russia's number one partner, has a 34% share of Russia's trade, largely by buying Russian oil and gas that Europe doesn't buy anymore. China and India now altogether have an estimated 85 to 90% of Russia's seaborne crude oil. Now, I want to point you out to a guy named Jai Shankar, who I watched again last night, and he had a recent appearance in front of an economic group, an economic forum, and it was a European economic forum on doing business with India, and they were talking on this issue, and he said he doesn't care. He said, it's not going to stop it. Remember, they're paying in rupees and in rubles. So I don't think it's going to change. China spokesman said there are no winners in a tariff war. And China said it won't bow to Trump's demands and stop trading with Russia. And indeed, such pressure will push China and Russia even closer economically and politically. It's not what you want. India is Russia's number two oil customer. And they greatly increased their imports of discounted Russian oil after 2022. Brazil is also a huge buyer of Russian fertilizer. India has tried to maintain a neutral stance, and they continue to say it through Jai Shankar and others, and they trade with them. 100% U.S. tariff on Indian goods or embargo on Indian oil purchase might strain U.S.-India strategic partnership, but so far, Indian officials have been saying publicly that Graham's warning about blood money from Russia oil would see it as, they would see it as an attack on its own energy security. And domestically in India, others will use it to stoke anti-American sentiment and push for more use of rupee ruble arrangements to bypass the dollar. That's what's gonna happen. Other BRICS in the global south. Brazil, a big buyer of Russian fertilizer and an exporter of food. Turkey, a NATO member but huge Russian energy importer. UAE, financial hub for Russian oil trade and a haven for a lot of oligarchs. And others like Vietnam, Thailand, Saudi Arabia, which has various dealings with Russia, could all be impacted. But many of these countries practice non-alliant and alignment, I mean, and they will strongly resent Washington dictating their foreign trade. People hate it. They don't want to be told what to do. So all you're doing, Lindsey Graham, is speeding up the decline. Brazilian President Lula has been very vocal about finding alternatives to the dollar in trade. Turkey's economy hit by tariffs or loss of Russian gas, they might capitulate. Turkey. But we can expect these nations to protest or find workarounds that, it's not going to work. But from Trump's perspective, he thinks that this is meant to amplify pressure on Putin and isolate Russia. But Russia isn't isolated. Nonsense. He's attempting to force people to do something by creating a global economic blockade of Russia. They're all coming up with ways to escape from the SWIFT system, to escape from a lot of stuff. What is the risk to the U.S. economy? Imposing 100% tariffs on major trade partners means Americans would pay dramatically more for imported products, like electronics to clothes and raw materials. It will also fuel domestic inflation and disrupt supply chains. If China, which is the U.S.'s largest goods supplier. For them, a tariff war would drive up consumer prices and spook the financial market. CBS noted that when Trump first floated the 100% tariffs, Russian markets rose because investors doubted that Trump would follow through, given his history of threatening tariffs and then softening. That's a very important point. I'm not sure that he'll do it anyway. But also, the absence of panic suggested that markets assume cooler heads would prevail before a full global trade war erupts. If Trump pulls the trigger on this, the shock to the world economy could be very severe and trigger a recession or at least huge market turmoil. But more importantly, as I talked about last night, de-dollarization and BRICS, the most far-reaching consequences will be accelerating the move away from the dollar in U.S. trade or international trade. Countries threatened by U.S. sanctions, tariffs, have already a very strong motivation to create alternative payment systems to avoid U.S. financial leverage. Remember, even Saudi Arabia is doing this. So well before the ultimatum was ever mentioned, BRICS Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa has been expanded by 11 more countries as full members and a bunch more as partners. They've already been exploring for a couple, 3 years, the alternative reserve currency, which is the yuan, or at least increasing use of their own local currency. In late 2024, remember, I did a whole show on this last night, Putin and other BRICS leaders discussed a new BRICS currency in 2024, and Putin showed off a symbolic BRICS banknote. But what did Trump say? We require commitment that they won't create a new BRICS currency or back any other currency to replace the mighty U.S. dollar. Remember that speech? Or they will face 100% tariffs. Nobody's afraid of your 100% tariffs. In other words, Trump explicitly tied his tariff threat to protecting the dollar's dominance. He's making a mistake here. He warned BRICS nations in November of 2024 after he was elected. Not a word about this while he was running for office, remember? And so after he was elected, he said, no alternative reserve currency, or we're going to come after you. With what? Now, by targeting China, India, Brazil over Russian trade, he's trying to follow through on that warning, but he can't. Many economists argue that this is going to backfire, including me. I realize my economics degree is only from the University of Illinois, but I still understand these supply and demand trends, right? Trump's threats and policies will only turbocharge de-dollarization, wrote the Asia Times. China and India conduct a lot of trade in yuan and rupees already, and with each other and with Russia. Sanctions is going to push them to expand these arrangements and invite others to join non-dollar bloc. Jeffrey Frankel in The Guardian noted that Trump seems to view a currency of BRICS as a serious threat, but said that such a currency is unlikely to succeed due to BRICS' internal differences. But the intent to sidestep the dollar, Israel and U.S. financial coercion would strengthen the resolve of BRICS countries to establish alternatives, even if not a single currency. Because remember, there's also a way to pay with their own currencies through their own central banks. Talk about global unity quickly, because that's another part of all of this. The global unity versus fragmentation. Trump's secondary sanctions put the U.S. at odds with some allies, like Turkey, some in NATO, some in Eastern Europe. Secondary sanctions legislation is a big deal. The Russian economy will survive. It might hurt them for a little bit, but long term, no big deal. Long term, Russia has weathered sanctions so far, and they will continue to do so. Trump's effectively wagering that the U.S. economic strength and the dollar's clout will help him enforce this ultimatum. I tell you what, he says he's prepared to endure a trade confrontation, but I'm not so sure he is. The dollar and the loss to it are notable. Trump is tying the Ukraine war to a broader battle against de-dollarization. If he goes too far, he would hasten the dollar's decline. That route is economic warfare, and economic wars have a very wide fallout. Keep track of all this, people. It is very important. Well, I have enjoyed having you on the program. I am glad you're here. My name is Samuel Trapp. This show is International Flavor. You are listening to Dem Radio. And Dem Radio has a lot of good programs. Tomorrow is the biggest day in radio. Let's call it that on Dem Radio. You go to demradio.com/live and listen to all of our great programs tomorrow. Plenty to talk about, plenty to get into. I have a show tomorrow that is going to be on Americans fighting for Russia and Ukraine. I got quite a few of them to talk about. It'll be an interesting program. I hope you join me to hear some of the research I've done on that and some of the consequences for people doing it. So listen to all my programs. Go out to internationalflavor.com and listen to back shows. This is, I think, my 149th. Tomorrow will be my 150th show of the season. So I look forward to seeing you tomorrow night. Join me every night from Sunday to Thursday, 9 p.m. until 10:30.